Dealing with Sexual Desire, the eighth talk in a series entitled Understanding and Living with the Dynamics of Sex, was presented as a panel discussion led by Jack Crabtree on November 14, 2007, at McKinsey Study Center's Wednesday night class. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2007. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Okay, the topic tonight is dealing with sexual desire, and I just have a few, I think they're relatively brief comments that I will make to get things started, and then we'll just see where our conversation goes. So, as I have on my notes, to frame the question, I want to pursue righteous obedience to God with respect to my sexuality as well as every other area of my life. At least that's the context in which I'm making my remarks. So the question is, how do I deal righteously and wisely with the sexual desires that I have? So I'm already ruling out just sort of shameless pursuit of any sort of sexual fulfillment of any sexual desire that I want to. That's to be shameless. If I can flaunt my being given over to animal desire and glory in it, that's shamelessness. I'm not interested in shamelessness. I'm ruling that out. So, that comment. So as wrong as this is, at least it acknowledges the validity of being sexually righteous. That would have made more sense in another context where this used to be in the outline. So. Dealing with sexual desire. There are wrong ways to deal with it, it seems to me, wrong ways to think about it. And the first one is that it's wrong to think that sexual desire is inherently sinful and inconsistent with holiness. That's just wrong.
Amen.
And anything that any way in which we think along those lines, we need to cut that out and correct that. There are three wrong approaches, it seems to me, that follow from that. The first is that sexual desire is already sinful. I'm already experiencing sexual desire, so it's too late to be righteous. I might as well indulge my sexual desires. That's the wrong way to think about this. Sexual desire per se is not already sinful. As shocking as that might be to some people in Christian culture, I would say that I think Jesus could very well have experienced sexual desire. Sexual lust is desire that is left unchecked by one's desire for righteousness. Jesus' righteousness, his moral perfection, did not consist of him being asexual. It didn't consist of him being void of any desire, being attracted to the idea of sexual fulfillment. It's that he liked righteousness more. And that's an entirely different concept of holiness than one that tries to make us asexual. Another wrong approach would be to mask my experiencing sexual desire with piety, all the while being in denial about my desire. I think that's an approach that gets encouraged sometimes within Christianity, that I don't dare admit that I have sexual desires because that's contrary to holiness, so I pretend like I don't have them, and I just simply mask it somehow with my chosen form of piety. That's a wrong way to address the issue. Or, more commonly, I seek ways or techniques to stop having the desires. So what I want to do is rid myself of desires. That's my goal. That's my project. So I'm going to go to seminars, read books, get involved with groups that will help me somehow rid myself of sexual desire. On the one hand, I will argue that's unrealistic, because if we are human beings, we will not be ridded of our sexual desires because we are sexual beings. Furthermore, that's not sanctification. And I'll say more about that a little bit later. But the kind of holiness that we are being called to is not of being ridded of desires. It's rather handling those desires differently. So we'll talk about that a little bit in a second. Holiness is not being desire-free, it is being in control of myself in the face of my desire. And of course, that's the trick, is how do you control yourself? So we'll talk about that in a second. Second wrong way to deal with or think about sexual desire: any and every sexual desire is inherently natural and therefore good and can freely be satisfied. Sexual desire is natural, that's true. But just because sexual desire is natural and consistent with holiness, that does not mean that every manifestation of it or every indulgence of gratifying the sexual desire is natural and good. Ron can maybe talk about this, but there's an argument that Paul makes in 1 Corinthians where the argument that's being thrown back to Paul is food is for the stomach and the stomach is for food, so why can't I have sex? Yeah, especially when I put it that way. Yeah. And Paul's response is, but the body is for the Lord, and the Lord is for the body. The point is that there's more to sexuality than just meeting a biological desire. There's more happening there, and it has moral and spiritual implications. And when we have more, when an action has moral, spiritual implications, then it's a question of my body is given to me to serve the Lord with, not to gratify. But Ron can tell you more about that. So, what's the right way to deal with, if those are the wrong ways, what's the right way to deal with and think about sexual desire? First, we need to practice self-control, countering sexual desire with a desire to be good, righteous, pure, noble, and loving. As a human being who is created to be a sexual being, sex will be interesting to me at some level right now. But being a godly, righteous individual is even more interesting to me right now. That's where we need to get to. Not ridding ourselves of sexual desire, but becoming so intent and focused on the value of righteousness and having that be what I want to define my existence, that desire for righteousness actually trumps my desire for sexual gratification. It becomes so important to me that it swamps the other desire, if you will, in a sense. So how do we overcome this compelling desire? Because sex is a very compelling desire, I don't need to tell you that. How do we keep from yielding to it and seeking to gratify it when we ought not to, in contexts where we ought not to? The false perspective is that I think that there are definable, doable steps we can take that will empower us to overcome compelling desires that we can't otherwise overcome. I'm offering four possibilities that somebody could lay out there, four steps to controlling sexual desire. One, don't allow yourself to dwell on your sexual desires. Try to distract yourself however you can. Well, apart from the distracting part, it's certainly true that we would want to make a choice to not dwell on our sexual desires and actually encourage them and feed them and augment them, amplify them in my psychological experience. That's true enough, but it's going to take more than distraction to really deal with sexual desires in a way consistent with holiness. Second, watch what sexual stimuli you permit in your life. Don't look at pictures of naked women. Don't go to movies, etc., etc. Can that be helpful? Sure. I mean, that sexual stimuli certainly do enhance sexual desire. They create sexual desire, and so I can, to some extent, monitor my sexual desire by monitoring the stimulus, the input. So there's some truth to that, and that may very well be the choices that I make. Watch what you talk about with a woman or a man. Don't talk about things that are too intimate, especially intimate things about sex or relationships. That's certainly true, that talk can stimulate sexual desire, intimate talk in particular. So, by curtailing that, I'm going to go a long way toward not encouraging sexual desire that otherwise would be created and encouraged. And then finally, watch the environment you put yourself in when you are with a woman. Don't take a walk under the moonlight, etc., etc. all that stuff has a certain core wisdom to it, and it may dictate choices that I will make. But the problem with all of them, the problem with any sort of approach that says, let's just figure out the key, the technique, the process, the steps to go through that's going to empower me to have this control over sexual desire. None of these four steps, how do I do these four steps when really my desire is to not do those steps? Why would I take the steps when what I really want is sexual desire and its gratification? That's the real problem. That's the real issue. And those four steps aren't going to be effective in solving that problem. The right perspective, I think, rather, is that there's one and only one thing that can and will empower me to the extent that I can be empowered. One and only one thing that can and will empower me to overcome the compelling sexual desires that we can't otherwise control, namely an existential commitment, a personal commitment, an inner commitment, an individual defining commitment to goodness and righteousness, a commitment that's stronger than my desire for sex itself. And I can't stress that enough. I was reading a magazine the other day, and I flipped open to an ad for a brand new college. I don't even remember the name of the college. But the whole college is about nothing but what they call spiritual formation, which is really basically going back to the old tried and true practices of Christianity, fasting, prayer, meditation, living a simple life, a life of poverty, isolation, hermitage. I don't know if they sit on poles or not, but... Huh? Yeah. I just got angry because the fact of the matter is all of us have this problem. And this problem is that we feel powerless. We feel powerless to believe, powerless to know God, powerless to serve God, powerless to pursue righteousness, powerless to pursue goodness. And we look at our lives and say, well, I'm a Christian, and it's not supposed to be this way. I must be missing something. And then along comes somebody who's going to sell me the latest and greatest thing that's going to fill up that which is lacking in my Christian walk. It used to be the Spirit of God and the charismatic phenomenon and speaking in tongues and being an apostle or a prophet or something like that used to do it. That's got kind of boring and tedious and mainstream and not really doing the trick any longer. The newest fad is spiritual formation. Come to me and I will be your spiritual coach and your mentor, and I will take you through some exercises that's going to just absolutely change you on the inside so that you can now be a better person. None of that junk works. The only thing that works is becoming clearer and more focused and more committed to the truth. And the truth is that the kind of human being that I really ought to want to be is a human being who's good, who's kind, who's compassionate, who's just, who is truthful, who has integrity, who's pure in my pursuit of goodness, and particularly, probably the key word is, I'm single-minded in my commitment to all those things. The thing that saps the strength out of us spiritually is our double-mindedness. We're not sure what we want. We're not sure who we want to be. Yeah, this Jesus thing is intriguing and interesting, and yeah, righteousness and goodness and all that, it's got some points in its favor. But there's this other stuff I want too. I don't care how many times you fast, pray, meditate, whip yourself, sit on a pole, that's not going to make you single-minded. The only thing that's going to make you single-minded is you just simply deciding and resolving at the core of your being, you know who I want to be? I want to be a good person. If you've ever seen What's Eating Gilbert Grape, there's one line in that movie that's just worth the entire, all of Hollywood. There's this guy just sitting on the side of a hill talking to a young woman he's met, and she asks him, well, what do you want to be? Or, what do you want to be? And I think with the obvious kind of implication. What do you want to be when you grow up? What are you going to do? What vocation you want to pursue? And the line's delivered very well, I think. He just sort of pensively and with a real kind of sincerity says, I want to be a good person. And if we could just take that, I mean, probably he's phony as could be. He's an actor. He doesn't want to be a good person. But if you could make that, if you could make that authentic and have that be the cry of each and every one of our hearts, that's where the power is going to come from. A single-minded commitment out of which we can say, when all is said and done, there just ain't nothing else that I want in life. I just want to be a good person. If we can resolve that within ourselves, it won't mean we're infallible. It won't mean we won't fall. It won't mean that we won't still struggle with other desires, alien desires to that. But it's the only thing that's going to help us even begin to be able to come to terms with our sexual desires. That's any power that is to be had is going to come from that, I would maintain. So the fuller, stronger, and more mature my commitment to righteousness, the more empowered I will feel to not fulfill my physical desires inappropriately. I should have added. That's all I have.
Yes. Actually, this is just a quick question for Jack. I wonder if you could expand on, you said right at the end, it's not going to keep me from failing. Could you talk a little bit about what failure is like or what our perspective on failure should be?
Well, the biblical teaching doesn't expect anything but failure, because we are, as Paul puts it, we are of flesh, sold into bondage to sin. So I'm going to fail. And if one of the worst things that we in Christian culture do is kind of set this really incredibly unrealistic expectation, come to Jesus and stop being bad anymore. I mean, that's just terrible, because it's out of touch with the truth. It's out of touch with reality. So we are going to fail, and we are going to fail sexually, one way or the other. I mean, that's just true. What was your question? What do you want me to say more about that? But I will be failing not because I'm unclear on what I want. I will be failing not out of duplicity. I will be failing out of weakness. I'm just too weak to be able to not have the sinfulness of my flesh sabotage my own efforts. But what's going to win out in the end in my life is if I am single-minded in my commitment to pursuing righteousness, then I'm going to pick myself up and try again. I'm going to keep going. I'm going to accept the mercy and the forgiveness of God for my failure. That's crucial. There would be no Christian gospel without the message of God's mercy and forgiveness. God is not damning us for my sexual failures. The only thing that damns us is not accepting that I need mercy and not receiving his mercy. That's what damns us, not my sinful failures of any kind. And is that...
Well, can I ask... This is a huge topic. I don't know where you want to go with this, but you're telling us to be single-minded, but there will be failure. Now, you alluded to it a little bit. You said not out of duplicity, but out of weakness. Mm-hmm. But I think this is a challenging topic for people who wrestle with whether it's sexuality or anything else. If I'm failing, presumably I did something that I wanted to do, and if I wanted to do it, then how could I, and it was wrong, then how could I consider myself to be single-minded?
He's got you there. He's got me there. How do I get out of it?
I usually just give the mic to Matt.
Want is a tricky, desire is a tricky concept when it comes to looking at the anatomy of human behavior. In Romans, he says, that which I want to do, I do not do. The very thing I don't want to do, that's what I do. I mean, he could have put it, that which I want to do, I don't want to do. The very thing I want to do, that's what I don't want to do.
And he said that before the internet.
Exactly. There's two levels at which you can talk about desire. I think there are the desires of the flesh on the one hand, and then there are the desires of my mind, my heart, my spirit on the other hand. The double-mindedness is at the level of the commitments of my heart, the commitments of my spirit, the commitments of my mind, that my self-defining resolve, who do I want to be? At that level, we cannot be double-minded. And in fact, ultimately, double-minded, not overcoming double-mindedness at that level means we're not even really a person of faith. We're not a believer. So that's a crucial fight that we have to fight. But what we will never be rid of this side of eternity are those desires bubbling up from the flesh, from my natural-born humanity. Those are always going to be there. And that's why my life here is always a fight. It's a fight, a struggle, a race. Warfare, that's the language, a labor, a work. The Sabbath rest is when God recreates me and makes my mind and my being in sync with my mind, where there's no longer a fight, no longer a disconnect between what my sinfulness would want to do and what my mind commitment wants to do. Then I can rest. That's the Sabbath rest.
Where do you get that?
I guess what I want to ask is then what place is there for God in this?
Oh, did I forget him?
Because it seems like if all there is I need to decide, and then I will be empowered, then what's the point of being a Christian if everybody can decide?
Well, nobody can decide without God. That's the trick. Mm. Is that why is it that you and I would resolve to be single-minded? Because the author of our being, the creator of our being, has got me and is working on my insides to bring about that free decision on my part to resolve to be committed to the things of God. I haven't referred them to God here, but from a biblical perspective, true goodness is godliness. I mean, you can't separate goodness and God from a biblical perspective. And I'm just assuming that here. I mean, the goodness that we are committed to is the godlikeness that we were created for.
It might be helpful. There is a huge practical and theological story back behind the question that you're asking here, and I think it's a very important one. It's a question that I've thought about and wrestled with really from the very first of becoming a Christian. But the reason that Jack puts it the way he does is you just have to decide is... It's clear that the Bible paints a picture that it is the work of the Spirit of God that is bringing about what the Bible calls sanctification. That is, my becoming more a person that actually cares about what is right, who's willing to admit that I am not what I ought to be and look to God for mercy and believe the promises that he's making, that he will forgive me and he is ultimately going to restore my life and all of that. I mean... that becoming that sort of person, growing in faith and a desire for what is good and a trust in God and all of that is a spiritual work. It is the work of the Spirit of God. So in that sense, my very hope that I could ever be such a person is resting on God. It's all about God. What has happened, though, in various strains of Christian theology, I would argue, and I think I'm agreeing with Jack on this question, is because we have seen that it is all about God and the work of the Spirit of God, there has been a tendency, and we could point to various theological streams, that have taken then the work of the Spirit and turned it into something like a technique or a pill that I can take. You know, so what advice would I give you if you're struggling with being sexually pure? You should use the technique of the Spirit. The reason that you're struggling is that you haven't, and so both Jack and I come from a theological tradition where we were taught that there are ways to bring the power of the Spirit and make it happen to you. That, you know, well, yeah, that's that was, but it was that sort of thing. I mean, we were taught that walking by the Spirit in the, as it's described in the Bible, is a technique. Let go and let God was the phrase that was sometimes used, or there was this analogy that many of the teachers in this movement used. When we are Christians, we are all issued the shiny new Cadillac, but most Christians are behind their Cadillac, pushing it along, you know, trying to do it on their own. Whereas what you really need to do is jump in and turn on the engine, and then the car will take you where you want to go. So spirituality was seen as this thing. The reason that I'm not having as much moral success as I might is that I have not learned to let go and let the power of God work through me, or whatever. I mean, there are different versions of how that works. So, but by putting it the way Jack is, what I would say, and I mean, I identify with what Jack's saying. I think it's right. What I'm looking to is, yeah, there isn't a technique. There isn't a thing that if I say this or open myself up this way or something, that it will make me a more powerfully righteous person. What I am looking for is for God to work in me, to strengthen my trust in Him, to strengthen my desire for what is good, to basically that I would become mature, that my faith would become strong, and so on. And the Bible paints a picture of the process that the way that happens is mostly through difficulties and suffering and the testing of my faith, where I have to actually live out the things that I believe, and I grow in that process. So, yeah, in one sense you can say what it's all about is I have to decide what I'm about. But as I'm living my life and trying to make that decision, what am I about, I am also crying out to God, have mercy on me, I am such a fool, I could easily walk right up to the greatest treasure in the world and walk right past it. So, you know, I want the wind of the Spirit to blow through my heart. I want to see. I want my eyes to be open. I don't want to be a fool. So in that sense, it's all about God. I'm not coming to God saying, I've figured it out. You know, you made it kind of tough, but I was smart enough to figure out what it was all about, and now I'm here for my stuff. I mean, it's, I'm counting on God. The very fact, if it is true, and I hope it is true, but if it is true that I have come to any sort of maturity in my faith over the years that I have been a believer, it is because the Spirit of God has been at work in my life in the midst of various things, helping me to get some things straight. So yeah, I think it's an important question you're asking, because the last thing we would want to communicate is what we're basically talking about is you just need to suck it up and do it. That's not the spirit of this. Is what we need is the Spirit of God to rescue us. But there isn't any other way for the Spirit of God to rescue me except for me to have my eyes opened to see, yeah, that's what I want to be about. I mean, as I come to be more and more convinced that being saved by God is what I want, and being a person like Jesus is my goal in life, although I don't know how to get there, the more that becomes a part of my person, that's going to affect the choices I make and the way I live my life, and that is a work of God. But it's not a work of God that comes about by me reading more passages or chanting things or meditating or anything like that. There, I mean, meditation can be fine, reading the Bible is a good thing, but in the end, what I'm looking for is a transformation. And that transformation will look like you know, I'm more committed now. I may be more of a mess than I was in some ways when I was younger, but I am more committed to the things of the faith now than I was when I was younger. And that is a thing that is done by God, but lived out by me.
So then the only thing we can do is to make this decision, but in order to make that decision, there is nothing we can do to make that decision.
Well, but make it.
Well, that's the thing.
Well, because you said that God needs to,
well, but,
to do
yeah,
the
that,
first work. So.
Right, but yeah, don't misunderstand me. It's very easy to take this kind of perspective and say, oh, I see. I just basically sit back and don't do anything, and I'll wait for God to someday change me into a different sort of person. But doing nothing is making a choice. If goodness is there in front of me, and I'm saying, well, I don't really care much about that, I'll just wait around until God makes me a person that cares about it, well, then I'm a person who doesn't care about it. I mean, I'm choosing, I'm looking at it and saying, that's not of much interest.
But I can't make a decision to make a commitment if God doesn't make me make that decision. So I would just be this person who doesn't care.
Just because of your inclination toward wickedness, that's why that's the case. As a human being, you can choose whatever you want to do to define your life. And as it happens, we're inclined toward wickedness.
Try to get to where they want.
And that's why it's a miracle that any of us ever become single-mindedly committed to goodness and the truth.
And I think the other clarification is that place that God is operating is not a place that we necessarily have access to. What we have access to is our choices. And so what God is doing behind the scenes in blowing the Spirit through my heart so that I can see well enough to see goodness in front of me and go for it, that's His commitment to me, and that's what He's doing. But I don't necessarily... I mean, the way the wind of the Spirit blows into my heart is by my noticing, I mean, the effect of the leaves blowing that you see with the wind, that you know the wind is blowing. Well, the thing that you see is I actually end up wanting goodness. And that's the evidence that the wind is blowing. But on the level of my experience, I have to decide what I want. And that's where I live. Is that helpful? So I think that comes together with this perspective of, and I think that there's a lot that comes with sexual desire in particular, that we have so much pressure on us in the culture that we live in, as well as in the context of just our communal needs, and what I mean by that is living in a time when families are so fractured and communities are so fractured. I think we have an amped up, in a way, emotional need for connection. And I think this is part of our the availability of sex on every corner, coupled with an increase in genuine, legitimate need, just sets us up big time for not doing well at this. And I think it is really clarifying over time as I decide, what do I want to be about? What voices, what influences do I want to listen to and do I want to move toward? It's huge. And it's a really difficult call. And so one of the reasons I wanted Jack to talk about failure is because what I wouldn't want us to be saying is that that when I fail at this, it means I'm duplicitous. It means I'm double-minded. It means I don't have faith. Because if I had faith, I could be single-minded and I wouldn't struggle like this. I don't think that's the case. And I don't think that's what anybody's saying here. But I think that's a really important thing to clarify is, am I failing because I don't care about goodness? Or am I failing because this is really hard? And I'm kind of a mess. and I'm full of needs and wants and flesh, and my culture is full of here it is, take it. You know, it's just, it's a tough place to be. But I think, well, I'm talking too much. I'll stop there for now. Is that helpful at all?
Yeah, I think so.
I don't want to leave this topic without just emphasizing one thing. Don't let me go on and on. Somebody else ask a question. But the picture that Jack is painting and my response to this, I think of this as a hopeful thing. I mean, sanctification is not something that happens to a few obscure hyper-Christians somewhere. I mean, this is the work of the Spirit in every single believer. That is, there is not a believer who is a believer who is not, that the Spirit of God is not engaged in their life and in the midst of the struggles of their life, bringing them to see how much they need God's mercy and helping them to long for the righteousness of character that God has and all of that. That's our birthright as believers. That's what God does. So it's not that ideal, I'm waiting for God to do something. That's not a you're tough out of luck, there's nothing you can do about it message. It's a God is engaged in my life right at this very moment in the midst of these struggles. And the process of maturity that comes through that is a precious and desirable thing. So I know, I mean, it sounds like it's not as good a message because if there's a technique that you can do, hey, I want to know that technique. And I've spent my life looking for those right from the very beginning. People would tell me, hey, there's this meeting where we're going to get into the really, the, you know, this is for the grown-ups. This is for the people who really want to go for it. And I go, oh, I got to go to that meeting because that's what I want. I want the super stuff, you know. And I don't believe in it anymore. I don't think it's out there. There is one, you are a disciple of Christ with the Spirit of God at work in you, or you're not. And if you are, then important things are happening. And if you're not, then not. The only warning in what Jack is saying and that I would say as well is let's not kid ourselves into thinking that we've arrived at some sort of victory over sexuality over sexual sin because we have managed to find a technique where, you know, every time I see something tempting, I count to 10 and just say a Bible verse or whatever it might be. I mean, in the end, what's going to happen is you're going to come to the spot where that's not going to work, and then you're going to be devastated. What does that say about me? And I never know quite what to say about this stuff, but let me just say, and I hope this isn't discouraging to you, but I, as a human being, sexuality is an issue that I have struggled with my entire life. I'm not really done struggling with it, even in my 50s. I mean, and yet, at the same time, the struggle has been one of God's key ways of getting my attention and making me confront the question of what do I want and what does the mercy of God mean and all of that kind of stuff. So, I mean, on the one hand, it might sound kind of bleak. You mean I'm going to be as old as you and I'm still going to be wrestling with this stuff? And maybe not. I mean, I doubtless I have a much worse problem than other people do with this stuff. But at the same time, I just think it's important to realize, I mean, in all of those struggles for me, the question of who is God and what does he think of me and what does his grace mean to me and what do I want in life and all of those, that has really helped me to have to, I can't push those questions aside and say, you know, I have never been able to say to myself, I've pretty much got everything together, because I've always got, and this is not the only area of my life either, I mean, we could talk about others, where I just have to say, you know, I can't even pretend that I've got it all together. And that brings me back to that question. So what are you about? And where's this going? And I would say, personal testimony, I believe that my faith has grown and matured greatly in the years that I have been a Christian. And part of that has been through a process of really screwing up often. So.
I have another question about...
throw it down.
You said that we have to make this decision to goodness and righteousness. And what Nancy said about failure, it's easy to measure failure, I find, in my life. But it's harder to recognize success or goodness, because at times I feel like, well, that's kind of ambiguous. I don't know if I'm really done anything good there.
But it's you recognizing that it's the failure. It's the response to the failure that's the key. I don't remember. I mean, Brownie points, the times I've done good, I swear it was mostly by accident. Like it was people going, wow, you did a great job. You really had the right words for that person. And I was like, oh, did I say anything besides cussing? I swear, it's like the things we even would like to attribute to ourselves are often just the grace of God putting you in a certain position. And so the success over some vice we might have, or the success that we all crave so that we can say, oh, no, I'm on the right track. Oh, my salvation is not assured, but maybe I'm a little closer. Like, maybe when there's a, you know, I get to heaven, God will recognize me a little better than he'll recognize Hitler. Like maybe. But it's the, I mean, for me, I'm on the boat with Ron. Sexual desire has been kind of with the defining crucible of my existence. In no measure do I feel my failures sting more profoundly. But it was recognizing them as failures, and it was failing. The count it all joy when you've encountered various trials and tribulations. That's the point. The point is that you suck. The point is that you're terrible at trying to get this on the right road. The point is that you can't do it. And growing up, I thought that if God had removed my sexual desire, I would be the greatest Christian in the world. All that crap that youth pastors used to say about, you know, if we just had 12 people on this earth who could really follow Jesus, did we change the world again? I just thought, man, well, if God would help me with the pornography, I'd be rocking the free world all the time. I was dedicated to bad things when I was young. And part of that had to do with just the curriculum that God gave me to struggle with. Not all of us are going to have the same faults. Not all of us are going to struggle with our sexual desire in the same way. But the reason why I'm so excited to talk about this subject is because, for me, it's been the area that I have felt I have been the most miserable failure. And I feel that, ultimately, as I've stepped back and understood things, that was where I became more that was where I became more sanctified. I caught it for the tape. I self-edited it. I feel like it's been sexual desire in both the positive and negative sense that have really shaped me and humbled me and taken to my knees more often than not. And it's been the fact that ultimately I don't think the part of me that likes and still likes the part of the evil, evil is such a bad word, the part of sexual desire that is a lie. Evil, it simplifies it too much. The sexual desires that I feel, there are two kinds. There's kinds that put other people first and value other people, and there's a part of me that just wants to gratify a lie. Evil is to speak about someone's desire as if it's of the devil, and it's a little too platonic for me. The flesh that I have, the sexual desire I have, it kind of branches out, it feels like, there are times when I feel like my sexual desire is noble and appropriate, and there are times when it's devious, for lack of a better phrase. It wants to believe something that's just bull. And so, but the struggle, that feels like, I look back I got exposed to a lot of things way early, and not in like a negative sense. I just found all sorts of cool magazines in places. And so, I think we should spit that out, because I think we need to know, all of us have that, different experiences with sexuality, and mine's that. And all the torturous, terrible things that I felt and some of the emotions were out of place just because I thought I was supposed to be perfect. And sexual desire has been used in my life to keep me humble and to ultimately show me that, you're not going to pray your way through existence. You're not going to find, like Ron describes the magic pill, like The point to be sanctified is to struggle. Like, that is the whole of it. Like, and when you give up the struggle, when you kind of just say, you know, I mean, the little justifications, I mean, Jack could only cover a few on the book. I mean, you could think all sorts of justifications for, like, going with sexual desire, but, like, but the fact that it's a struggle seems like that's the thing that matters. I mean, I don't know. I'm sorry.
Well, yeah, that's great. And I think it's a great question you're asking, because, I mean, this is the danger of saying it. I want to make the focus of my life to pursue righteousness. Let me tell you how I think about that, because you're right. It's, if I'm looking for success, I'm with Calvin. You know, I think that, I mean, he said something about how at our greatest, most pious, giving, wonderful moment, if you looked at it carefully, you could find it just shot full of, you know, selfishness and you know, I think I'm a big deal and all of that kind of stuff. I mean, basically saying, you know, the most noble thing I ever did, if you looked at it carefully, there's plenty of there for me to be ashamed of, you know. And I think that's just true. So it's not that I'm saying I'm going to set out to become this successful, righteous person so that I can say, ah, now I've arrived at this. But let's take righteousness and make it a little more concrete. Let's talk about love. I recognize, I have come to see what a wonderful and beautiful thing it is when one person thinks about the other person's needs in a truly kind of giving way. I really do care about your situation. Even if it's going to cost me, I care about that. There's something really beautiful about that. Living in a world where we were all treating each other that way all the time would be a fantastic thing. I mean, it is so great. I mean, I practically weep when I see an example of you just catch somebody doing that sort of selfless thing. I mean, and it is a great, that has a lot to do with what we're called to. I mean, righteousness, that's one of the key components of it. Love your neighbor as yourself. Well, I'm committed to that. I long for it. I think it is important, and it is beautiful, and it is what my life as a human being is meant to be about in many ways, along with some other things. But, so it is the focus of my life, in a sense. That's what I want. Now, how often do I fail? How often do I get self-protective or defensive or more concerned with my stuff or just tired and I don't want to deal with it and all that kind of stuff? I do that all the time. But it doesn't mean that love is not the focus of my life. It is. It is my call. It's like the siren song. I hear it and say, yes, that's what I want. And I don't know how to get there, but that's what I want. So, yeah, if you asked me, so how successful were you today, Ron, at being selfless and loving and all that kind of stuff? I said, I don't know. Probably not, well, absolutely not nearly as much as I would like to be. But I don't think I'm a hypocrite. That is, it's not that I'm saying one thing and I'm really about something else. I really am about that. I'm just not any good at it. And I don't know that I'm going to get much better at it before I die. But I want to. And part of the reason that I want to go and be a citizen in the kingdom of God is I hear that's the place where everybody is that way all the time. And that's why if you come along and say, you know, hey, go down this road over here, it might be a little shady, but we can get you some nice stuff in this world. It's pretty nice. Part of the reason I don't go down that road, I might go a little ways, but I don't ultimately go down that road, is I say, well, yeah, but that's not as good a deal as what I'm getting over here. What I'm getting over here is an eternal life of being a loving person with other people who love me as much as I love them under the care and guidance of God and his Messiah. You don't have as good a deal as they do. I mean, and that's looking at that.
The fiery pit at the other end.
Yeah, right, yeah. That's that one doesn't work out too good either. But, I mean, you see what I'm saying? That's my hope. That's my desire. That's why I keep going down this road, is because that's what I want. So, in that sense, it is the call, it is the thing that I am pursuing. But it is very hard to be a person about that, no matter who you are. And so in that sense, I'm not worried about measuring my success. I But I am concerned that I continue to be a person who wants that. So I pick myself up again and again and again and say, that's not what I want to be about. God forgive me, God help me, and now let's go again.
So I think I understand what you're saying, but what you're not saying, how do I get my butt into heaven? You're saying that's not how we should, why we should be doing goodness.
No, because I'm not even, I'm just not even in the game, if you want to talk about what it would take for God to look at me and say, hey, now that's what I'm talking about, you come in. That's not, the whole point
you're
is...
You're not even in the running.
Huh?
You're not even in the running, you're in the clay.
No, that's... And that's why, that's what's so important, I think, about this, is that I come to see, one of the things that I have learned by having lived a while is that the more I come to know about myself, the worse it looks. I've seen more of what's in here than I had a chance to see when I was your age. So is that discouraging? Well, not anymore, because I know that's the deal. I know what it's about. But so, no, it's not about getting me into heaven. But what is about getting me into heaven is God has said, you have a serious problem, and I have the solution. You do have to make this choice. Do you believe me? Do you agree with me that you have this serious problem? And do you trust me to solve it the way I have said, that I will forgive you and I will restore you and give you life? And I do have that choice to make. Do I believe him? Do I want what he's offered? And that is that engages every fiber of my being. That's what my life is engaged in, is the struggle to remember that promise, to believe it, and to keep going for that. So in that sense, yes, I am constantly making this decision, not to make myself good enough to get into heaven, but to remember my problem and turn to the God who can solve it. So in that sense, I'm about getting into heaven. I want to choose the life that God is offering and not walk away from it. But it's not by being a good person that I'm going to accomplish that. And the more I know that, the more I recognize that it is the mercy of God, the more freedom I have to look honestly at myself. I couldn't look honestly at myself when I was a younger man because it was too scary, because I was afraid I might find out something that would disqualify me from life and blessing and whatever I might be looking for. Now, I understand enough about the mercy of God that I can open my eyes a little bit and look and see, okay, what is going on with this guy? Because if it turns out to be really bad, well, I was told that already. It's really bad. And it's not the fact that it's really bad that's going to keep me from arriving at life in the end. So, I'm sorry, I'm talking a very long time.
I just like being someone who desires to be single-minded and isn't single-minded. The allure of heaven is less that I get to spend time with people in heaven. I don't really care. I don't know if I'm going to know anybody. I don't know if I'm going to make it. But the allure of heaven. What I'm staking so much of, what I want, the promise that I think God is offering is the promise that when I get to heaven, I will be single-minded. Like, and that's the most alluring thing. I don't care if the streets are gold. Like, I don't care if I'm the trash guy. I don't even care. Ultimately, I don't care if I get sent to hell, as long as I'm single-minded in hell, and not in a bad way. Like, single-minded in a good way. Like, I don't mind the torment and pain I've suffered here, because the goal, the purpose of the torment and pain I've suffered here has been that one day, if I can overcome, et cetera, et cetera, there might be a promise that I will get to be single-minded. And the world that I view and the person I will be the person I've always hoped I would be and will never be here and will continue to fail obsessively.
Bust it.
I have two questions. The first one is, so this commitment that, like, you've been talking about, Like, I understand, or at least it seems like it's a commitment that, like, will be happening all my life, and I'll always be, like, trying to sort out, like, what I'm about. But is that, how do I say this? Like, I guess what we've been talking about this whole time, just, like, failing after we've made this commitment, and Chiron. and just, like, failing after we made this commitment, and, and, I mean, it's nice you guys are saying that that doesn't mean that, like, that commitment's not true, that it doesn't mean that, like, you made that commitment and then you can't fail ever again. But I still have a hard time understanding, like, when I know that commitment's, like, been made and it's true, because I, like, and maybe it's because, like, of, like, the, like, evangelical view, you, like, do the prayer and receive Christ and then your life's changed, and then 2 weeks later it's not and it's the same. And so I don't, so, yeah, I'm not really sure what I'm asking. So I don't know if, like, I guess it would be nice to know that, like, I know what I'm about and that I, like, I really, really desire to be this person, like, regardless of how many times I fail at that, but like, am I not going to know that? Like, is that, like, am I always going to be asking myself, like, whether I'm actually committed to this thing, or can I say, yes, I am committed to this thing, and I'm going to keep failing, but I'm still going to be committed? Or, like, is the commitment more of a, like, I'm going to be constantly trying to figure out whether I'm committed or not? Does that make sense at all?
Yeah. I would answer that with a yes, that I think you can get to. I think we do come to a place. Over time, our struggles clarify our decision about that. And so there might be a time when I'm asking that question a lot. Is this what I want to be about? And it's a live question, because there's choices here that I'm definitely deciding about, and I know what it means. If I choose this one, I'm kind of saying I don't want goodness. I mean, there's real defining choices in our lives like that. And I think that when we go through those experiences over time, as it continues to show us, and I actually still want to go toward goodness, or maybe I didn't want to then, and now I do, there does come to be a time, I think, when I pretty much know that that's what I'm going for now. So when Ron talks about still struggling in his 50s, I'm going to put words in his mouth and say, I don't think he's talking about struggling with, am I single-minded or not? It's, I'm struggling with the fact that I'm still a sinner. And that I will always struggle with. But I think we get clearer as we go along. And I think there's often, everybody's experience is different, but I think there's often a particular experience or juncture where my faith is proven to me on some pretty deep level, that beyond that, I don't question that in the same way. Is that...
Yeah.
Does that work?
When I was 19, I think I sat in that, not in those cushions, but I was in a chair and Jack was here and I asked the same question and he went, well, I think my question was, Jack, how do you know that you're saved? And I think, I'm not sure Jack quoted the donkey from Animal Farm, but something along the line that he's had the experiences, and ultimately this was of no comfort to me because I was like 19, which I'm like, great, like I got nothing. So, but not only do you find that you do you make decisions out of the character of your, totally out of character of the character of your youth. That didn't work out well. But I've made decisions now in my life that seem abhorrently nice. Like they were good decisions. Like they were like not typically Toby decisions. And big decisions that have determined the whole course. I mean, a lot of events like have been shaped by certain things I've done that were unquestionably out of character, and that's a good thing. And in addition,
all of a sudden, I mean, and in youth, it was crazy. I mean, I was young, and I think I've struggled. I don't know if I struggled more than all of you in the room combined, but it felt like that. And as you get older, you actually start to see goodness for goodness, opposed to some vague thing that is the opposite of evil, because you feel bad for evil, and you want what doesn't feel bad, so goodness is over here. But eventually you see goodness and go, wow, I actually care about the good. Like, I actually do want to be single-minded, even though I'm not single-minded. And the line between lies and truth and selfishness and unselfishness becomes more defined as the more you make those decisions and the more you live. So you're 19, right, Beth? Yeah, you should be worried about your salvation every night. You're fine. Just persevere. You'll be fine.
There was a really popular seminar back in the 60s probably, called Basic Youth Conflicts, and just thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of Christians were taking these seminars. And I remember him addressing the question of doubts about whether or not you're saved. And his solution was that you go into your room and you open your Bible to certain verses that he told you to have open to, and you get on your knees and you pray for Jesus to come into your heart. And then you read the verses where he promised to come into your heart. And then take a stake and write the date on the stake. And then go out and pound it in the ground behind the barn. I didn't have a barn. That was part of my
barn. Yeah, you're screaming. Yeah. Barn.
And then whenever you have doubts, go look at the stake.
Wait, a stake isn't a meat?
No.
Exactly what I think every time I hear that.
The translation there, and that might have been the problem. You gotta have a barn and a steak, the right kind of steak, like a kill vampire steak.
Yeah, a wooden
steak.
A wooden steak.
I never understood that. Bill that Gothard used sense. To say that, and I would go.
Why?
I'm sorry. I didn't hear what you said.
Oh, no, I was just saying, yeah, sorry, that makes more sense.
Now, the problem, I wasn't real smart back then, but even I was smart enough to realize, but my doubt is not for lack of steak, a steak.
Or barbecue,
yeah. My doubt is, I don't know whether I mean it when I pray it. I mean, isn't that was the, I didn't know whether I was, my heart was right, whether I was genuine, whether I was authentic or anything like that. But we crave to know the answer to that question, and there are plenty of people who are going to try to give us really glib, easy answers for myself. And I think what Toby's saying that I agree with is that there are no easy answers to that. As a young believer, we are going to live with the torment of not actually knowing whether I'm authentic or not, because it's going to take time. And the way Paul puts it in Romans is that he says, we exult in the hope of the glory of God, and we not only this, but we also exult in our tribulations, knowing that tribulation brings about perseverance, and perseverance brings about, and uses the word dokime, which I think is the word he's using for the attestedness of the authenticity of my faith and my standing in God's eyes. Well, it takes perseverance, which takes time, which takes life rushing at you with all the junk that I have to face, threatening to flush me out, you know, just flush me out of my discipleship with Jesus. And the fact that it doesn't, that's where you look back on your life and go, whoa, why am I still standing? Why am I still even interested in Jesus after all he's done to me? After all the crap that he's given me, why am I still interested in following him? And you look at that and go, there's only one explanation. God has me by the neck, and he's not going to let me go. That's where real certainty comes from. That's where the knowledge comes from of where I actually stand. And I don't think there's any substitute for that.
Yeah. And the other question was about, sexual sin and the church. And I don't know how many churches this is the case, but it seems like it's in a lot of them that, if you have sexually sinned, I mean, there's some other, major sins, too, but that's, one of the main ones. Yeah. Well, yeah, I know.
The minor sins, which are the ones that are kind of okay.
like villains, yeah. And or, you know, like suicide or things like that. Like that you have to, well, first of all, well, just like this whole process is like you can't come to the church for a while, and then like you can't participate in the Holy Supper, is that the word? Yeah. Like for a while either. And I guess it depends like how long. And then you have to like stand in front of everyone and apologize and all those things. Yeah, and that seems, yeah, I don't know. Like, it seems like it's, like, at least from what I've seen, that has a lot more to do with, like, it seems like it's a lot more about, like, people being like, oh, I'm sorry, church, that I wronged you, and not, like, actually anything to do with God. But I don't know, like, is there something in the Bible about that, or, like, totally does that seem totally completely 100%?
Oh, we all want them in this one. This is a fun one.
Well, I was just going to, just very quickly, for example, you talk about communion, the Lord's Supper. There is a passage, Paul talks about how they should examine themselves. Before, he's talking to the Corinthians about before they take the Lord's Supper. And that has been read very carelessly, I think, and people have taken away from it the idea that the Lord's Supper is such a holy rite that you can't sully it by being any sort of a sinner and be involved in it. So if there's any sin in your life, you can't participate, and you have to examine yourself and cleanse yourself somehow of this before you involve yourself. Whereas if you look at the context and the issue that Paul's talking about there, the examination that he's talking about is to examine yourself as to whether you're a believer or not. That what he's really concerned with is the people who are taking the Lord's Supper in a very cavalier sort of way. In fact, they get together and the rich people, they bring a big meal and they don't share with the people that don't have much because they're really more concerned about their status and having a great meal, and they don't really care all that much about the people who supposedly Christ died for and that they're brothers in Christ. So the examine yourself there is you really shouldn't be doing this if you're not convinced that in fact you are a sinner who needs the mercy of God. But if you look at yourself and you see that I am a sinner who needs the mercy of God, then doing a ceremony that is celebrating the death of Christ to rescue you from sin is a very appropriate thing to do. So I think some of the things that you're running into in the church, they come from an interpretive tradition. We've taken certain passages and I would say kind of twisted them and turned them into rules and rituals that are not really what it was about. So that's just an example.
And the other passage is the one that says, if your brother sins, go to him. If he sins again, take two or three people. And if he still keeps sinning, take him before the church. And I'm not sure I fully understand everything that's going on in that passage, but the one thing that I am convinced is that we have perverted that as well, because, you know, everything from the shunning by the, you know, conservative Mennonites and Amish to going before the church and having to humble yourself before the church and ask for forgiveness and all that kind of stuff, we've turned it into a kind of sociological technique for making people knuckle under and conform and stop being loyal to everything that we stand for. And we're going to put pressure on you to make sure that you knuckle under. I don't think that's at all what Jesus had in mind. I think rather he had quite the opposite in mind, that his concern about, you know, part of that is make him, if they don't listen to you, then make him like a tax gatherer and a sinner. I think the point that he's making, I mean, the thing about tax gatherers and sinners is Jesus didn't ostracize them. He partied with them. And the thing that's significant about that is what he means by make them like a tax gatherer and a sinner is that you don't allow them to live with the self-delusion that they are on the same page with you with respect to their belief in the gospel and in Jesus and in the mercy of God and so on. People who are making
choices that are clearly indicating that they don't believe any of this stuff, then don't be a part of a support structure that says, no, you're one of us. Yeah, you're one of us. You're fine. Don't worry about it. You're one of us. Instead, the message we should send to somebody like that is, you know, I don't know. I'm not your judge, but you're not looking much like it to me. From where I sit, it doesn't look like you really believe this stuff. Now, we're not ostracizing them. We can still socialize with them. We can still be their friend. We can still love them. We can still be kind to them. But we're going to stop short of saying, let me be a part of your self-delusion. Let me tell you you're okay when I really don't think you are okay. I really think that's all that passage is about.
There's two questions over here and then one up front.
I just was going to say that there's been times in the past where I kind of wish people or certain close friends of mine and or back home said that type of thing to me, in as much as something's not lining up here. But on a different note, and this may be, it is an off-topic question. That's a shocker for me. But one thing that's been very close to my mind lately in the area of just being a follower of Jesus in general is and this is somewhat of an abstract question, but not fully. Right before you die, is there any sense that God in the scripture indicates that there's a sense of deep trust, a sense of not worrying and realizing that now you're kind of crossing over for good type of thing? Not this kind of holy, there's an angel standing by me, but the idea of what is the gospel reaction to dying well? If that's a good question.
Well, I think it is. I'm concerned that it's off topic in a way that there's some people that want to maybe ask about what we're talking about, and I think it's a valuable question. I don't want to diss it. I don't think that there's, if you're talking about a pleasant death experience or a peaceful experience of dying, are we promised that? I don't think so. But I think, are we promised safe passage? Absolutely. My favorite picture is out of, I think it's, is it in A Pilgrim's Progress? Where the pilgrim feels like he's going to drown on the way across the river. And he's going under, and he feels like he's going under for the last time. And then the shepherd reaches out and pulls him out. And he makes it. And then the angels sing, and he's in. He's there. But we could talk more about that. But Aaron, what
was my knowledge, the Bible doesn't talk about death experience at all. It doesn't address it.
My question is a little bit off topic for tonight, too, but it's in keeping with the series as a whole, so hopefully it's okay. You guys have talked about, I'm pretty sure, maybe I'm putting words in your mouth now, but when you're deciding to get married, it's important that the two people be about the same thing. I think that may have been David's phrase. I'm not sure. But it's really important that they be committed to the same thing fundamentally if it's going to be a good marriage. So I'm kind of wondering about that in light of what we were talking about tonight with the struggle to figure out whether you actually are a genuine believer. How should that factor into your decision to head towards marriage?
For you or for them?
me specifically?
I think you need to disqualify yourself from answering this question.
Young lady.
Just let me clarify what's happening here.
I could understand that question from two perspectives. As I'm thinking about getting married to someone, how confident should I be in my own maturity as a believer or something like that? Or how confident should I be that the person that I'm getting married to is so which of the, were you thinking
well,
of one of those in particular?
I was assuming I was mostly meaning like for yourself, because I mean I think that it's important to try to figure out whether the other person is too, but I think that's a different process than, you know, finding out that you really are committed to goodness. So yeah, I guess like it seems like in the interest of being honest to anyone that you were thinking about getting married to, it seems like it would be important to know that about yourself, but it also sounds like you're saying that that's a lifelong process. So any comments on that?
I don't think we're saying it's a lifelong process.
Okay.
You know, what's more common is to talk about the born-again experience. That's this kind of watershed experience that on the far side of the born-again experience you weren't a believer on, and this side of the born-again experience you were. But I think the biblical picture is more not a born-again event, but a whole nine-month pregnancy. I mean, to stay with the metaphor, it's as if your intrigue with this dude Jesus starts, and you start developing a commitment, a belief, a faith in Jesus, and it grows and it develops. But it's still fragile. It could still miscarry. And life comes at you, and it recommends some other options for you, and sometimes people take it. But there comes a point in time where we've been tried and tested and sorted out enough by life that we come to that point where we really can not only say to ourselves, but can look back on the history and see that it's happened to me, and it's been tested and tried and authenticated, that I guess I really want this thing. I guess this is what I'm all about. And that, I think, is what the New Testament calls someone who is teleos, is the Greek word. It's often translated perfect, which is a terrible translation, I think. That those who have reached the telos of this process of being wooed into discipleship with Jesus. As long as you're just being wooed, you're not really there to stay. But there comes a point where you kind of make an irreversible decision. This is where I am. This is who I am. I ain't going nowhere else. And that's someone who's teleos in the faith. And I think that happens in our lifetime. I have to think that, because Paul in Galatians says, as many of you as are teleos, what's he say, bear the burdens of those who are weak. So he seems to know this category of people who have come to the point where they know who they are. They know they're here to stay.
The thing we seem to be continually coming to is this elusive process of sanctification. And Christianity, if it's collectively going to burn in hell, is going to burn in hell for wanting to set up a way to measure a human being. We have the big sins, little sins, and we have what, you know, oh, this person's on fire for Christ. That person would make a great husband. Or even a Gutenberg. I mean, if you're really serious about the great books, now there's a person to marry. So, I mean, Jack kind of answered for the self. I mean, in essence, when you watch that other person, it is more important to watch closely how they fail than where they look like they're succeeding. Like, it is more important to see, are they aware of their absolute tyrannical wretchedness? Like, I mean, are they aware of, like, that they're really going to stab you in the back in the future? I mean, like, are they aware of that? And is there a disgust in them for that? Like, is there something in them that isn't at peace? Like, because Christianity wants to measure us because we have the successful Christian living. I mean, that's, if there's a gimmick out there that's been sold more than prostitution, which would be the oldest tradition in the world, but if there's one out there, it's the Christian gimmick of, oh man, your life is going to be great and nice. And I just think that really, when you get to know someone, watch how they fail. Watch how they come to terms with what they did wrong, and ultimately there should be a discord in them, a desire and longing to be other, because they're not other. They're as messed up as you are. So, I don't know. I would just want to say genuine and honesty is a nice trait to see in another person and a nice trait to have yourself.
That's very helpful. I think there is one part of my question I'm not sure if it has been quite discussed yet. Maybe I wasn't clear about it. But so Jack, you said that process of sanctification, whatever that elusive process is, that's something that you think you arrive at some sort of conclusion to in our lifetime. Is that the sort of thing, okay, this might sound really silly, but I'm going to ask you anyway, is that the sort of thing that you need to wait for before you decide to make a lifetime commitment?
That's what I was hearing in your question, and I think that, I think what Toby's saying addresses that in the sense of all I can do is evaluate. You're saying I need to evaluate me, and I think that's really right. I got to look at that for me because I'm about to promise that to another person. Am I really clear about that? Is that really what I want? That's a really valuable place to start. But then in evaluating what about this person's commitment to that, I think we can look for indicators that are things like how do they respond to their failure? What do they do when they do they fail? Do they get and I don't mean like right in the moment because none of us do well in that moment, but more like how does that person come back to it when they hurt another person? Do they justify themselves? Do they prove how many ways they were justified in doing that and how right it was for them to do that and hang on to that for dear life, or do they come to a place of recognition of how hurtful they were and regret over that? And I think that's an enormous indicator light of someone's heart. And if that person also likes God and likes Jesus, then, you know, that's a pretty good indicator. Now, can that change? It can. I mean, on some level, you're taking a risk, the same risk that you're taking in your own life until it's more confirmed over time through trials. So,
You never eliminate the risk out of that decision, and that's where you just throw yourself on the mercy of God and say, God, here I go, take me for your ride, not mine.
I guess part of my question would be, is there a point at which you would look at yourself and go, you know what, I'm pretty certain about this other person, but I'm too uncertain about what's going on in myself to commit to another person because I don't want to end up being the sort of person that's going to hurt them. Like, when do you decide that, like, you have come far enough in your process of sanctification? Does that make any sense? You're giving me that look.
Well, yeah, I think that's a bigger question than marriage, though. That's a question that I think is really an important question, whether or not you have somebody you're about to promise your life to. So absolutely be clarifying that for yourself. Do you wait to marry because it's not clear to you? Sure. I think that would make sense. On the one hand, I mean, you know.
Yeah, I mean, but mix it up. I mean, like, the point isn't not making mistakes in life. The point is, yeah. I mean, the point is trying to strive. And so, looking at yourself, seeing doubts, I mean, I think that's beautiful. And to not want to inflict your fallenness on someone else is extremely noble, but if they know you, they're not clueless to the fact that you're pretty wretched yourself. So I mean, I think to bring it all in a nice little package, that the coolest part of marriage is when the person sees how wretched you are and is still cool with you the next day. Like, that is one of the things that have healed me the most from all the millions of years I had of this crazy, terrible existence that I've had, is just having sexual desires and then getting married and someone coming to terms with the fact that you're as wretched as you promised you would be and they still wake up with you and still like you. I just think that's the coolest thing in the world. That's the best gift of God that God has ever given me so far. And if I get grace, it's going to come after that.
Yeah. And Aaron, we've sort of come full circle too. I mean, that's an important question to ask, but that's something you can do something about. That's what I was trying to stress in my comments, is that if I get to a point right now, and if a
potential marriage is what has brought me to the point where I'm taking a look at myself and saying, what am I all about? You know, what do I want my life to be all about? You don't have to wait. Decide.
Well, that makes sense.
Right. James.
So what do you do if you've decided yourself you want to commit your life to goodness and you marry somebody because you think they want that too, and 10 years down the road it becomes apparent they don't?
that's pretty apparent, huh? It's that easy.
That's a tough one.
we have to trust in the sovereignty of God that we're all on a different journey. We're all in the midst of a different narrative and a different story, and that may be a story that is mine. And bummer.
I mean, what if you marry someone and they die of cancer? I mean, like, it's kind of like, you know what? You don't get to determine your curriculum. God gets to determine your curriculum. And that is the essence. I mean, being married to someone is extremely trying. And then for them, hypothetically, then end up... I mean, I think it's a funny question because oftentimes the thing that I've always identified in my wife that I was like, wow, I don't know if this takes over her, she's in big trouble. Oftentimes, every time I've said that out loud or in my mind, I've, like, 6 months later, I've been like, oh, no, I was the problem the whole time. I mean, like, that's how funny fallenness is. And so, yeah, I can imagine a clear-cut picture where you married someone for 10 years. It's they just, you know, they're walking away from Christ. But every time I hear people say that, I'm like, man, that guy's probably a jerk, though. Like, I'd walk away from him. So I just think that human fallenness goes both ways, and you're lucky. Just worry about your own fallenness, other people's fallenness. That's not your problem. You worry about you.
And just keep in mind, marriage is not ultimately about your happiness.
Mm-hmm.
It's about the curriculum. And that would be an incredibly wonderful growing experience. Wouldn't be a lot of fun sometimes, but it would be a wonderful growing experience.
This is actually more going back to the topic of tonight.
Thank God.
But it seems like in the course of tonight, especially early on, we sort of differentiated between a couple different types of commitment to righteousness. There's like there's the type of commitment that is actually played out in our actions and in our everyday lives and in kind of, I guess, the type of commitment to righteousness that none of us actually have and none of us can have because we're fallen human beings. And then there's this kind of overarching commitment that you're saying is more of a recognition that thing that I can't do and that I can't get is valuable, and that's what I should have, and I want that, even though I recognize that I can't do it. So here's my question. When at the end of your notes, when you say that the way that we deal with this is we commit ourselves to righteousness, which of those two types of commitment are you talking about?
Well, the second one, but let me add some things to your description of the second one that I think was implied by everybody up here, even though it may not have been explicit. If we are disciples of Jesus, we are running after the life that he has for us. We're fighting to get there. We're striving to get there. We're striving to make my actions, even right now, conform to the obedience and the righteousness and the goodness that he's instructing me should be the way I should live my life. So if you're committed to that kind of righteousness, it's going to change your life. It's going to change your behavior. It's going to change your actions. It's going to change the choices you make. That's what I mean by it, that it, if it really is a single-minded commitment to that, it's kind of empowering. What everyone is emphasizing, however, is given the nature of human sinfulness, we're striving against the inertia of sin that's always going to drag me into failure of one kind or another. So that's part of the picture, is that I'm struggling and fighting to crawl out of the mud, but the mud is always going to get me to some extent.
So that then is what basically you're saying is that the two types of commitment are not entirely unrelated?
Yeah.
That
yeah.
That
both of them manifest themselves in your life.
you said the first one shows up in your life and the other one was kind of this overarching. Both of them manifest themselves in your life. But the second kind is being honest about the fact that it's not manifesting itself in my life as perfect righteousness, but it is changing my priorities and the things I'm pursuing. And so you could tell the difference. I mean, there'll be something different there.
And then that's, I'm assuming that that's then why there's the room to still fail, right. Is because even if you have this overarching commitment that empowers you to some extent, that there's still the fact that in your daily life and how this translates into your actions that you're still falling.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Thanks.
I have a few. I want to pursue righteousness, righteous obedience to God with respect to my sexuality as well as every other area of my life. How do I deal righteously and wisely with the sexual desires that I have? Question is, the sexual desires that we're speaking of and we have been speaking of, that's like lust, right? Like physical want of like gratification of my physical wants and desires, like sexual desire, like as opposed to like the desire for sex, like in a man and his wife communication form of sex. Like it's not that desire for that sex, but it's like the physical lust. That's what we're talking about.
So you can't lust after your wife?
Well, that was my next question. You're getting ahead of me.
Well, what I mean by sexual desire is just that physical, visceral, organic attraction to a female.
Mm-hmm.
And
unsexiest words ever, visceral.
Visceral. I mean,
you look so visceral tonight.
Would somebody shut the parrot up? I would say lust is something different. Lust is that desire that is not being met with and checked with my desire for righteousness. So when I say I think Jesus could have had sexual desire, I think mm-hmm. he had sexual desire, but I don't think he had lust.
Right.
Because as quickly as the desire was there, he was saying, but I'm not married to her.
Yeah.
That's not interesting to me.
So it's like a physical occurrence, and it's like the seeds of lust.
Yeah.
Basically, like in your body. And then...
Could I add something to that?
Yes,
I think it's part of our humanness, and it's part of our physicality, and there isn't anything wrong with it. And mm-hmm. I think that's where Jack is trying to say it's visceral.
Visceral.
But it's part of our being human. We're made sexual. We have hormones that fuel that. We have physiology that fuels that. We have anatomy that fuels that. And it's there. And... the fact that it's there is not a bad thing. It's a good thing. If I'm aroused in some way by some stimulation of some kind, it's not a bad thing. It just reminds me that I'm a sexual person. And then where I go with that is the decision I have to make.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where it's kind of, we're slowing down what we're saying here. And then I have a decision to make, okay, my body would really like satisfaction right now. Is it appropriate that I get satisfaction right now? Maybe. If I have my partner there who I'm married to and, you know, he's game, sure. But but it's true.
That's,
no, it's true.
Why is that weird? It's just like,
it's,
no, that's how it is.
Exactly. It's like, why not? That's what it's for.
Yeah.
It's to enjoy with one another.
Yeah, yeah.
But if I'm not married and I want that to be satisfied and there's a person next to me that I'm attracted to, is it appropriate that I move forward with that? No. If I have magazines in front of me, is it appropriate that I move forward with that? Do I treat my body like an amusement park? No.
Mm-hmm.
I have to check that desire against, do I want something more than I want that satisfaction? And I think that's where Jack is saying, if I can really understand that goodness is ultimately going to be far more satisfying to my soul and my character and my being, when I become captivated with that vision, then that will help me with my discipline. And it takes discipline because we are sexual. and it's not always available to us. So anyway, had to go off on that one.
That's a good segue into this, because right under that, it says, this is the opposite of being shameless. So would that be being shameful? Like, are we supposed to be shameful as a way to deal with this sexual desire?
I'm glad you brought, because I was going to bring up at the bottom page one, the right way to deal with and think about it. Practice self-control. Yeah, we talked about that. Good luck with that.
Yeah.
Countering sexual desire with the desire to be good, not that you're going to feel good. Like, righteous, not that you're going to feel very righteous. Pure, not that you're going to feel very pure. Noble, not that you're going to feel very noble. And loving, yes. Like, shame, I mean, this is really, I mean, why I was excited about talking this. I mean, I grew up with a lot of shame, like a lot of shame. And to not be ashamed of the fact that you have a sex drive is good. Like, and it isn't necessarily even shame that we need to feel when we fail. It's conviction. I mean, like, shame is I mean, I suppose, I mean, shame is a tricky emotion, and I'm not entirely sure that there's a lot of good that comes out of it. Like, conviction's a good emotion. Mm-hmm. Like, when you fail to feel, to continue to strive, to continue to try to do better the next time, like, that seems a more valuable emotion. But to feel shame, I'm not sure how much shame really got me anywhere when I was really in the mix of it. Like, when I was really trying to be a Christian and struggling with my sex drive as a young man, like, the shame seemed to distract me from what I actually should be doing. Shame was there because I thought I had to be perfect. And I thought that this thing that I was doing was some terrible, unnatural, like, if my church found out, they would, you know, send me to the hills to live for the rest of my life kind of thing. And, like if anything, Christianity has failed us, it's the fact that it's incapable of talking about the subject without, I mean, the story I got was, oh no, don't go near that, you can't think those kinds of things, and you can't do those kinds of things. Oh, you're married now? Go for it. But that's not how it is. I mean, at that point in my existence, I already had so much shame built up in my life that, like, I mean, it very much was something that me and my wife had to talk about and still have to talk about. Like, so I don't find shame to be holy or righteous in any sense. But conviction, that's the money. Like, conviction's the thing that you strive out of. And the thing that when you fail, you even go, you know, yeah, I got to stop doing this. But I will. I'm going to strive. I ain't going to give up. So I think, I don't know if you want to add something.
I agree with everything he said, absolutely. But I do think there's a way of understanding why we experience shame, because it comes pretty automatically. I think we are taught it, but I think it comes automatically even if we're not taught it. I think Paul is getting at it in 1 Corinthians when he says every sin that a man commits is outside the body, but sexual immorality is, and he uses a different preposition, in the body, against the body. I'm not sure how to translate it. But I think what he's getting at is there is really something unique about sexual immorality. Because it involves my body, when I an act of sexual immorality is taking my sexuality and not putting it in the context of morality. I'm just doing what my sexual instincts want to do, and I'm not asking the question, but is it the right thing to do? And notice what that means. What it means is I'm acting like an animal. And I think that's where the shame comes from, is we feel degraded. We feel, I guess degraded is the right word, we feel degraded, which is translates into a kind of shame, because I've just acted like an animal. So I think it's a very logical and rational and natural emotion that we experience, but it's a terrible tool to use against ourselves, and that's Toby's point, and I agree. That instead of trying to use the tool of shame to drive me away from it, my whole point was we need to focus on goodness and let that lure us to something higher and more noble and more.
And I would just add to that that I think it's really valuable and important to understand the nature of that, because sexual sin is in our bodies, it can be a very profoundly injurious experience to have it be trifled with in a way, or to for us to fail in that area, can be very difficult to work with. But I think it's really important that we understand the nature of mercy and the nature of the choice that we have every single time. We can decide. And so it's like you don't have to decide for the past. You can decide for the future, and the future can start at any moment. And I remember a statement made by someone I knew that I thought was profound, and that was, you might not be able to regain your virginity, but you can regain your chastity. And so being chaste and being sexually pure is something you can start today doing. And it's a valuable pursuit. Will you fail? Yeah. And will you wake up the next day and say, today's the day I'm going to be pure? That's, I think, the mercy that's available to us is amazing. And even the restoration that's available to us is amazing as we begin to focus on what's valuable and start to have or grow in our ability to control ourselves, that self-control that I think is really ultimately very ennobling and very good, that it actually does reclaim us in some way over time. And so we have a profound ability to heal also. So I just wanted to say that.
And God has a tendency, I mean, and I think God has a tendency to bring people into your life that help you. I mean, like, I think honesty is the remedy to these kinds of things. Like, when I was younger and I wasn't married, I mean, the groups that I would get together with guys and we would talk about these things, like, there was a healing process there and a wisdom that I got from interacting with my peers. And then, I mean, Ron knows that and Jack, all the professors knew that I was pretty blunt about everything I was dealing with. And the honesty there and the feedback I got from there. And then furthermore, once I got married, I mean, I feel like when you strive, in a way, you don't strive alone. Like, there are people who are there with you striving, and you're lucky if that's your wife, and you're lucky if those are your professors and your friends. Like, and so, I mean, the reason why I get so excited about this topic, the reason why the classes I got to sit on, this was going to be this is very dear to my heart, because it's where I felt the most grace in my life and where I felt the most forgiveness and the most healing from the damages that were partially self-inflicted and partially just the curriculum God gave me. I mean, like, as dark as my soul goes, and I know it goes very dark, a lot of those things were played out in the sexuality that I've struggled with all my life. And so the healing that I've gotten from wanting good, even when it didn't look good, even when it was far away, and even when I didn't feel good or worthy of it, I just think that's been something totally unexpected and totally, like as Nancy describes, a satisfying thing that all of a sudden you wake up and you want what's good because you see goodness for goodness and the lies for lies. And so growing up with as much pornography as I got to experience, it was almost impossible for me to view that as bad, because it just didn't look bad to me. Like, and all the wounds that I was inflicting myself, the ones that I felt and didn't feel, and the ones that affected me, like, coming out of that, and I'm with Ron, like, it'll take the whole of my existence to really understand goodness for how beautiful it is, and the lie and wickedness for how terrible it is. But it's just this kind of thing that you work it out, and if you're lucky to have people who care and who understand, then you are a lucky, lucky person. So,
those are very clear and concise answers. Thanks. And I got one more. So we're here, and we take this discussion of sexual desire and put it in the context of a marriage, not for, like, you or your spouse having sexual desire for some attractive man or woman on the street, but for one another. Like, what?
I think it's always appropriate to be loving. And so in the context of marriage, I have to work with my desire for satisfaction in a way that loves my spouse, and likewise, and vice versa. And so it isn't always the case that I'm going to get what I want, and I have to work with that, because loving that person is ultimately a higher calling. So, and we are so far out of time. We could pick this up next week. There's. Oh, we're scheduled, okay. But you know it is the day before Thanksgiving. Is anybody going to be here?
I'll be here.
Are you guys going to be here?
Yeah.
You coming? Okay. Okay. Good. We are scheduled for it. So, okay. And then we'll have one last class the week after, on Wednesday.
Let me just amen her answer that. Growing up in the church, I thought you just had to not be sexual until marriage, and then
go crazy.
And I realized that my wife had something to say about that. So the practice of self-control now is something it just makes you the person that you are, and you absolutely need to continue that the whole rest of your life.